This is a session titled Spirituality and Interpersonal Relations. Dick Hayne. Okay. And if we get there, maybe something about third world debt. I kind of structured my sessions to lay out some initial thoughts that I've been having about political spirituality that's, I think, very different than what you hear generally. In fact, quite the opposite of what you hear generally in many ways. And then I had thought that in the latter part of each session we'd deal with one justice issue and sit there and write a letter. Except that that's about 2 hours worth of activity, and so I tend to slight the issues just a little bit. We'll see whether we can get there very much to third world debt. And I don't really know what your primary interest is anyhow, so it seems that the first stuff keeps us going, so whether it's important to get to all of those issues, I'm not so clear. In my mind, I'm still adjusting to the Holden schema, even though I've been here a week. And in my mind, there are 10 presentations that all fit together. So, and they began a week ago, and they end next weekend. And of course, I realize now, you know, I've been here a week, and I realize people come and go every day. And so, you know, I might say something on Tuesday, and I'm going to modify it on Wednesday. I'm going to put a counterbalance in on Wednesday, but by Wednesday, the Tuesday people are gone, you know, so they don't get a chance to hear it. So what I thought I'd first do is just to give you some idea what I think I'm doing here, is do just a little recap of what I think I have done this past week, and then say something about what I intend to do my first presentation next week, which, as it turns out, comes on, I think, Tuesday. On Monday, I talked about grassroots activism. The general idea was that you can make a difference. You can participate with others through political processes in making a humane, just, peaceable, and sustainable world. And that the burden is on us to do that. If we don't do it, who's going to do it? I mean, who else is there to do it if we, you know, who have so many gifts of education and skills and training and income and the ability to speak and write and all of those wonderful gifts that we have, it's our opportunity and task to be those who change the world in behalf of justice. And so that we can do that through letter writing, phone calls, and such. On Tuesday, the claim I made was that political spirituality, I don't know if you read this or not, that political activity, now not just any political activity, I mean, some people lobby for some kind of break for their business, okay? There's all kinds of politics. There's good politics and bad politics, okay? But realistically, we tend to put politics down and put church up. There's good church and there's bad church, too. I mean, the church, we have the Inquisition. That was no happy day for a lot of people. You know, we had the Crusades. So every institution in society is a mixed bag. There's no institution that is totally pure, totally good, or probably even totally evil. So the particular kind of political activity I'm talking about here is political activity in behalf of justice, so not just any old political activity, is a spiritual vocation. And that's kind of the overall theme I'm trying to make. I should qualify it just a bit by saying, when I say political activity, I don't just mean lobbying and politics and stuff like that. I'm using political in its more grand and elegant sense, in the sense in which Aristotle used it, to say that political activity is the kind of reigning institution in a society. That is to say, it is the government, or it is the political activity of the people and their government, that decides what constitutes a good or a bad economic system, what constitutes good or bad schools, what constitutes adequate or inadequate transportation. So that within the polis or the city or the nation, within political activity, there is social activity and all kinds of social activity. So this is a session on spirituality and interpersonal relationships, but interpersonal relationships are part of the larger polis. They're part of the larger political scene. So this session is not really going to focus on politics and lobbying and that kind of stuff, but I still see it as a part of what I mean by political, okay, as a smaller part of what I mean by political. Political activity in behalf of justice is a spiritual vocation. And I have 4 points here. I don't know if they're going to work or not. Those of you that have been to some of my sessions before have heard me say these are ideas. I started a book-length manuscript. I got too busy organizing people to lobby and to write letters to write myself. That is to say, I got involved in the doing so heavily that it's been a year since I've had any time to work on any of these ideas. They're tentative. They're new ideas to me. I welcome your feedback, your criticisms, because they'll help me grow. They'll help me learn. And if I ever do get around to writing this up in a book, you may find that that you have saved me from an enormous disaster by straightening me out here early on before I got in front of a publisher. So I do invite that, not only within the session, but catch me. I'll be around all week, so catch me at any time, and I'm glad to talk to you. By that, I mean that it provides, that political activity in behalf of justice provides or generates spiritual experiences. And what do I mean by that? Well, what do you mean by a spiritual experience? Very often, there are a lot of different kinds of spiritual experiences. Some are experiences of deep peace, a deep feeling of well-being. I would say that if you have helped pass legislation or influence the governmental process so that nuclear war is less of a possibility, that can bring you a profound sense of deep peace that is equal to any other kind of spiritual experience you can have. Not better than, but equal to other kinds of spiritual experience. Or, if we have time today, I'm going to read you a letter of a young woman who participated in a demonstration. And I would want you to hear the ecstasies that roll through that letter. Ecstasies like unto spiritual experiences, ecstatic spiritual experiences. That it rises from spiritual values. That is to say, it rises from values oriented toward good. When I use the word good, well, it enlarges, that it has results. I take the somewhat probably difficult position that this stuff is supposed to result in something. That is, all of this faith stuff and all of this religious stuff, if it does not result in doing something about the environment, if it does not result in doing something about the poor, if it does not result in doing something about racism and sexism and homophobia and things like that, then we have to question it. We have to ask whether or not it is itself good. Mm-hmm. If it does not eventuate in good, then what we have to raise questions about the claims that it makes. So I would say that political activity on behalf of justice, spiritual activity, it enlarges the realm of spirit. God gets bigger. How can God get bigger? Well, if good gets bigger, I mean, if history is a kind of struggle between good and evil, then as good gets bigger, God gets bigger. That, of course, could be a lot to argue about. And that it is a way of coming to know God, or goddess, or however you wish to whatever way you wish to put that reality. I'm saying that through political activity, we can know dimensions of God that we do not know through other vehicles. Now, I'm not saying it's the only way you know God, by any means. There are lots of ways. I mean, here in a setting like this, you know God through the mountains, through the trees, through a lot of different ways. But I'm saying that political activity is a significant way through which we can come to know God. So that was kind of what I said on Tuesday. And I did some critique of church and seminary, and on Thursday, some critique of American culture. What functions as God in American culture? Things like success. That's what is God in American culture, and sometimes that's what functions as God in the church too. I do know clergy who are success oriented. I had a student who, just out of seminary, the combined income between student and spouse was $70,000 a year. That seems to me to be fairly inconsonant with the gospel that kept getting talked about on Sunday morning. I just couldn't put those realities together very clearly. When we talked yesterday, one of the things was entertainment functions as God in America. What is it we're willing to spend, you know, $5 or $10 or $50 for a ticket for, you know, that we won't spend even for church, you know, where we have some pretty serious commitments, you know. Fast food, an amazing phenomenon, fast food. Fast food is a kind of oxymoron. Oxymoron's one of my favorite words right now. An oxymoron is a phrase that that is self-negating. People used to say, and I don't believe this one, okay? Let me disclaim this one that I'm about to say, but it'll make the point. People used to say that military intelligence is an oxymoron. I don't believe that. I believe there is such a thing as military intelligence, but the one denies the other. I think that systematic theology is an oxymoron. I think if it's systematic, our minds are so small that if we got it systematized, it ain't God anymore. It's us. I think that fast food is an oxymoron. How can you have something that is nutritious, satisfying, through which the earth is replenished, through which humans live, and have it come out the end of the tube the way that stuff does? And yet, we spent 11.4 billion dollars at McDonald's in 1988. You tell me what functions as God in American culture. We don't even have time. We're so busy, so rushed. Where are we going, you know? What is it that's so important, you know? So that kind of do it now, get all the gusto you can. I don't think we believe really a whole lot in the afterlife, or we wouldn't have to cram it all into this life. I think that we say we believe in the afterlife, but we're in an awful hurry to get it all just as fast as we can possibly get it. So that was sort of Tuesday and Friday. Wednesday I said that public policy is a spiritual discipline. When we think about spiritual disciplines, we think about prayer, we think about a discipline, doing something on a regular basis and having to hunker down and really be rigorous about this, whether it's weight loss or whether it's, you know, exercise. Yeah, I'm going to get out there and I'm going to do it. Well, I want to say that public policy is a spiritual discipline, that it involves knowledge, commitment, tenacity. Some of you heard Tom Witt talk about tax resistance. I think that takes a lot of courage, it takes knowledge, it takes intentionality, it takes hanging in there. I'm not myself a tax resister, but I admire a lot people who are. That's one example, and certainly if you're going to try to understand U.S. and world agricultural policy and how stuff grown in Iowa affects farming in Senegal or somewhere, that's very complicated stuff. That's about as complicated as things get. So it takes a lot of discipline, it takes a lot of hanging in there, it takes a lot of structure and a lot of work to try and really get handles on how to make the good grow, how to make the realm over which God holds sway larger, how to enlarge the realm of spirit. So all of that for prior times. I went on a little more than I really meant to there. I get going. Today, spirituality and interpersonal relations. So today we're talking about the spirituality of sameness, pretty much, or relative sameness. The claim here is that already existent in our interpersonal relationships are all kinds of profound experiences that we could begin to discern as spiritual experiences. That is, we think we go to church to get spiritual experiences, and we do. You know, church is one place where this happens. Or we think we go to retreat centers to get spiritual experiences. The bottom line claim today is that we have profound spiritual experiences in the ordinariness of everyday life. It's just that we haven't learned to think of them as spiritual experiences. So this is just kind of trying to see these things a little differently. So today it's spirituality in relationship to those who are close to us, those who are close at hand to us. Monday, I'm going to talk about the other, how we are saved by the stranger, how salvation comes through the stranger, and that there is a profound spirituality in the relationship between self and the person or persons who are totally unlike oneself. That is, those who are close at hand tend to be more or less like us. But the spirituality of otherness and how we are saved by the stranger. Indeed, saved by the poor. And in some sense, and this is kind of an outrageous thing to say, I suppose, and certainly debatable, in some sense, God is saved by the poor. That is to say, but I'm trying to be just a little bit provocative, so maybe, you know, some of you might be interested to see, how could he say that? What does that mean? You know, I go in there on Tuesday and I'm going to tell him how he's wrong. Which is good, which is okay. Late one May, when I was traveling from Winnipeg, Canada, to Fort Worth, where I was living at the time, Texas, I stopped at the Minneapolis Museum of Art. And I think I got the right name. There's a bunch of art museums in Minneapolis. I'm not sure I've got the right name. I think that's it. I don't think it's the Walker. I've talked to people since then. And there's kind of like a whole bunch of, as you would expect in a museum, a whole bunch of doors there. And you go in, as I recall, there's a humongous, or at least at the time, there's a humongous painting on one of the walls. And there are steps that go up right there to the second floor, right there in that kind of front big hallway. And as I was going up those steps to see what was on the second floor at that exact moment, dozens of school buses pulled up. It was toward the end of the school year, and you know how it is. All those squirming little second and third and fourth graders and the teachers just barely surviving. And it's a good time to do an outing, you know, the huddled masses yearning to be free or something like that. And I was a little annoyed. I thought, God, you know, I have one chance in my life to get to Minneapolis, you know, maybe. I mean, maybe I'll never be back, never have been. And I have one chance to enjoy this museum and see what's here. And here come, you know, and all that noise and all those kids rushing through the doors, you know, it's like a river, you know, it was like one of these waterfalls out here, you know. In fact, it's, So they kind of, and it really was, it's like a river, they kind of rushing through the doors, and there are several hallways, and they kind of whoosh, whoosh, and off that way. And all of a sudden I realized that it was precisely this vitality, the color of the kids, you know, their outfits and all that, and the noise and the excitement and the babbling. This was what the artists were trying to capture. It's not the only thing, but it's part of what artists try to capture, is that vitality and that color and that excitement. And here I had it in real life right in front of me, and I was being annoyed because it was getting in the way of my looking at the pictures. Now, as I thought about that, I realized subsequently, and then what I did was, and what I usually do in art museums these days, is I look at the paintings, and then I look at the people. And then I look at the paintings, and then I look at the people. Because those two are very closely related, even if they're not paintings of people. Because the world of art and the world of ordinary social exchanges is a world that's very, I think, that one enriches and enlivens the other. I mean, suppose, what I realized was that what I needed was a change in my lens, okay, in order to see the kids as art, as living, flowing, moving, exciting art, okay? It's that kind of change in discernment that I'm asking you to try to make in this session today, and maybe in some of the other sessions, to change the lens through which you look. You expect to look at a reality in a certain way. You look at ordinary social, interpersonal interaction in a certain way. I'm asking you to change your lens and see how it looks as a spiritual experience, how it enlarges the realm of spirit. Take, for example, now this might be a somewhat debatable example, but some force to it at least. I was in church a little while back, and more than a little while back. But I mean, let me start that sentence over again. One time when I was in church, not long ago, I attend Luther Place Memorial Church in D.C. John Steinbrook was up there, and he had like four or five babies that he was trying to do a baptism. And at least three of them were crying. And as I listened to that thing, it was sort of like a symphony. Because Steinbrook, he had a microphone and everything. And, you know, the kids got louder and he got louder. And so you had his baritone kind of wah coming out like that. And you had the kids going, and it was kind of syncopated and kind of, it sounded like a sort of point counterpoint kind of thing. And essentially the kids were winning, and it was clearly annoying him a whole lot. He was keeping his cool, but he kept raising his voice, you know. Now, what's it like? You've all seen that in church. I mean, you've all seen that somewhere in church, you know? Or at the end of a wedding, you know, when the bride and groom kiss, and they haven't discussed it ahead of time, and one wants a deep, long, passionate kiss, and the other one wants to just peck and go, kind of. There's just a lot of experience. I would maintain that maybe the most important spiritual experience in that hour of the baptism, the most important spiritual experience for me in that hour was the children crying. What is it that people smile about? What is it that people are enjoying? You know? To me, that social interaction, new life, this baby saying, pay attention to me. Don't just do things to me. I have gas in my stomach. Why are you putting water on my head? Or whatever it is. That's life. That's human life. Emergent, saying, here I am, here I am, pay attention. To me, that's a profoundly spiritual kind of thing. But at least in my background, the spiritual thing was supposed to have been the baptism and the liturgy, and I love liturgy, okay, and all that. It's not that those aren't. But I think an awful lot of people go to church because of the interpersonal stuff that's there. They go because they like the people that are there, or because they think the pastor's a lousy preacher, but he sure did show up and get him through that death, and he or she, and that there's a kind of commitment that has grown out of the interpersonal connection between these people. And I would say that commitment is a manifestation of spirituality, is a real spiritual kind of thing. Give some other quick examples, and then I think that this applies in the realm, for example, sometimes of sexuality. We had a forum on sexuality last night. It's very interesting. It's an amazing hour, really. People of all parts, different perspectives, who were felt free to say where they were, and nobody, you know, attacked anybody else, and they acknowledged that they were just in kind of different places. I thought it was a really lovely occasion. Well, to me, spiritual or sexual ecstasy can be a spiritual experience. Sexuality can also be a minefield. We all know that, okay? There's more than good spirituality. There's good spirituality and bad spirituality. As I said the other day, somehow we have all lost our sense of the demonic. Only think of, when we say spirituality, throughout the years, people consider there were several possibilities for spirituality. Or I think of family relationships. When I am with my kids, I have four kids, and I'm divorced. I have an ex-wife. But we often get together for holidays, all six of us. And there is something profoundly ecstatic. And some of my kids go to church and some don't. So it's not a churchy thing at all. There's something profoundly ecstatic about this group of people in interaction with each other. I don't know. I don't know that I can describe it. And they're very different. I mean, my oldest daughter works in a grocery store. She lives in an apartment and is always somewhat in debt. And probably always will be, and I think, you know, I'm hoping she just kind of is self-supporting through her life. Her next younger brother is an accountant with an oil company, and he and a partner are fixing up now their third house, which they're going to offer for something like, I think, $350,000, $250,000, I forget, when you get up there it kind of loses me somewhere. And if they're successful at that, they'll each make $40,000 or $50,000 off this one house, and this is the third house they've sold. Of course, they started smaller and are building up. I mean, just like they're opposite people. Two people who would never, never, ever run around with each other, you know, if they weren't family, you know? They wouldn't run into each other, they wouldn't meet each other, they wouldn't hang out together, they wouldn't have my third is a daughter who has been a peace and justice feminist peace activist, work for Women Strike for Peace. And whereas neither of the two older children are all that interested in justice issues, she is passionately committed to those kinds of things. And my youngest son just finished 6 weeks ago going through a chemical dependency program for use of crystal. He's kind of marginalized a bit right now in the whole scheme of social economic scheme of things. But nonetheless, this group of people, when they get together, there is something there that is more profound than happens to me almost anywhere on the face of this earth. It is profound. It is deep. It is moving. It is caring. It is the extension of good. It is of God, and it can be nothing other than that. I think that in 12-step programs, I think next week they're talking about having a 12-step program, a program about 12-step programs. Because my son is my youngest son is involved in AA. I've started attending Al-Anon for parents and families of people with chemical dependencies. The whole thing, the 12-step thing, is brand new to me. Didn't know about it before. It's just completely new to me. But in AA or Al-Anon, people discover that the power they don't have by themselves, they begin to find in the group. There is a power bigger than themselves in this group. And then from this group, they begin to see that there is a power even beyond the group. The things they can't maybe pull off their addictions by themselves, but that there is a higher power which manifests itself through the Al-Anon or AA or, you know, Narcotics Anonymous or Overeaters Anonymous, whatever the various ones may be. I really do think that there's a lot of spirituality in our country going on today. And as I say, I'm kind of new to these programs, so I'm maybe speaking way ahead of my own knowledge, and I may later say, hey, I was just naive or something. But I, at this point, honestly believe that there is a kind of profound spirituality going on in 12-step groups, more so in some 12-step groups than in some churches. Although it leads some people to come back into their churches. And so I think that that's another manifestation of interpersonal relationships as a vehicle for spirituality. I think I've experienced it even in this week at Holden, people coming and going all the time, sharing with other people these interpersonal things. our spiritual experiences. I don't just have spiritual experiences at Vespers. I have them at Vespers. This is not an either-or kind of thing, okay? This is a kind of both-and kind of thing. I've had some very lovely spiritual experiences, going for a walk with someone and talking about our lives and enjoying, you know, the surroundings around here, or with the group on Tuesday, going up to Lake Holden. I was in a house church for about 4 years, a group of about a dozen people. We met one night a week for 4 years. That group became a profoundly spiritual group, and one of the members fell into a ditch. He was digging a ditch out on this kind of farm out by the lake, or not a farm, but a kind of rural area out by the lake. And he fell in the ditch, and he thought he had broken his leg when he fell in the ditch. And it turned out that he had a bone cancer right here, and that the leg had broken first, and that's why he fell in the ditch. This was on a Saturday night. Around 4 or 5 o'clock in the afternoon, the volunteer fire squad, it's really kind of rural, came, got him, put a temporary splint on his leg, hauled him into the hospital. Members of the house church started calling each other, and there were 5 out of the 12 of us there before they got the temporary splint off. That's one's image of what a group of people who love and care for each other is about. Turned out that he had internal melanoma, and that he died when he was 41, went through that with his wife, was there when they took the tube out so that he could be released. But we were there for each other through that whole process in a profoundly caring way. Yet we had no institutional affiliation any more than a 12-step group does. We had no official status. We had no clergy. We had no theology. We didn't even agree with each other. We used to fight about theology all the time. But we'd go fight about it, but we would walk out of there knowing that the love we had for each other was so profound that there was no difference bigger than our love for each other. To me, that group was a profoundly spiritual group. What I would like to do for a bit is, and I've just given some kind of quick examples, sexuality, family, house church, 12-step, Holden community. What I would like to do is have you break up into groups of maybe 3. And like where it's a couple who are here together, sit with somebody other than your spouse or somebody that you came with. Sit so that you can meet a new person and so that you can talk together. And I don't have any good way of doing it. I'm not going to count off into 3s. Just kind of move around a little bit and find a couple of other people. And I would invite you to share with each other some experience, some group, of an interpersonal sort, a love relationship, one-on-one, a family, an occasion, an event, a particular Christmas. Briefly, you can't go on at great super length, to share with some other person that experience, and then see if you can find in that some things that to you could be described as spiritual experiences, rising from spiritual values, enlarging the realm of spirit. I've talked more about the first one. Or through which God is revealed. I haven't talked about that one. I probably should say a word. I don't know if this one's going to work at all, but I went up to Lake Holden. Okay, and clearly God is revealed to me in nature. Okay, it's beautiful. But I thought as I walked back, you know, to me an airport is just the same. How can this be? Here these people have spent this money and taken all this time off to come to Holden Village. Because for me, when I'm in an airport and I look around, especially an international airport, and people are speaking all these different languages, and here are these people who are black and brown and Asian and maybe some Native Americans, and they're male and they're female and they're families, and some of them are clustering around and they're greeting and hugging and they're running to catch planes. And I sit there and look at them and think, I don't know you at all. You're a stranger to me. You don't even see me sitting over here looking at you. And I wonder what your life is like. You're a stranger to me, and yet you're just like me. And I mean, probably, you know. And we have many things in common, and yet there's a kind of mystery of the other. Even if you're married to that person for 20 or 30 or 40 years, there's a kind of mystery, a kind of opaqueness to the other. And so I guess my claim on this fourth point is that even as we can learn who or what God is through nature, our knowledge of who or what God is enlarged through knowing people. And the more diverse the kinds of people, the more we learn. We learn more from a person, say, who has a handicap such that they can never leave a wheelchair, than maybe we learn from someone who's very much like ourselves. We learn from someone who's had to live in a situation of deep oppression more about God than maybe someone who's, you know, another middle-class American like us, something like that. I think at least that's been my experience. So if you would now break up into groups and see if you can at least talk about your experiences. You'll have a good time with that, and if you can figure out any of this other stuff, well, that's a plus. And what I should have done somehow is taped each of those little groups, and I'd have so many good stories. I wouldn't have to sit around and think very much, you know, do the hard part. Before we get to it, just let me say a quick word lest I forget. Since I'm not going to make it to third world debt, obviously. Third world debt is part of what's killing the environment. You ask, what are the causes in the third world? It's one of the major causes, one of the major things that's preventing third world nations from being able to do something. Why are they cutting down the rainforest? Because of third world debt. So the way to get at that is to plant a tree. But the way to get at it on a larger macro structural level is to do something about third world debt. And most of you know I work for Bread for the World, and we lobby on third world debt, and that's really about all I'm going to say about that. Except that there's a newsletter here, one of our newsletters, and there's a background paper on third world debt. They're both by the door. Take as many as you want. I don't really care to haul them all back to back to the boat and so forth. Okay, so that on the way out. What did you were having a good time. Were you able to identify any of these experiences you were sharing? Does any of this work? See, I don't know. You're the first people that have heard this. I don't know if any of this works. And I'm as open to hearing no as yes, because I'd rather hear it now, as I said, than later. Like what? Were you able to identify any spiritual dimensions in interpersonal experiences, small group, one-on-ones? Can anybody name one? Name anything that has to do with this description on the board?
Chris had a very good experience. You feel like very experienced.
Well, I was just telling them that I go to school in PLU. This year we started my first time in it. We had a Bible study that would study the text for the following Sunday's sermon. And through the year it sort of whittled down to there was only three of us, but all three of us became rather closely bonded as each one of us went through a rather hard personal time.
So I think that's profoundly important. And in church life, it's often the bedside, the crisis time when somebody's there with you that bonds you to the church. Ministers like to believe that it's always the text, the gospel, that does it. But the gospel, you know, the word became flesh, and the flesh sits beside a bed sometimes. And it's that be very profound bonding as one works through a crisis with someone. Yeah. Any other examples, spiritual experiences, or could you discern any values behind the experiences that you could point to, or how in any way that it enrealms the spirit of good or God, or through which you have come to know God in a different way, you've seen a different facet of the divine through some interpersonal relationship? Yeah.
Well, I guess I'll tell you what I shared was about my first husband. He died of cancer 7 years ago. He wasn't a Christian. Mm-hmm. And I had prayed for 30 years for him to accept Christ. And it was really hard, you know, going to church alone and trying to raise a couple of girls and their dad saying, you don't have to go to church, you don't have to go to Sunday school. But when he found out he had cancer, and they told him it was very fast acting and a very rare form and no cure, so he lived 5.5 months. But we were in Arizona, he wanted to go down one last time, and the doctor said okay, and he ended up in the hospital, and friends down there, we'd gone to church with them, the Baptist church, and the pastor drove us to the airport. My husband's sister and her husband had come down and bring our travel trailer and dog and our van home, and so we flew home, and this pastor was talking to him about how he had changed and what a violent person he was, and how he had changed and accepted Christ and become a pastor. And it made a really deep impression on my husband. He accepted Christ and was baptized. And in the meantime, I was praying for him to be healed. All of this time, he wasn't. And when he died, my sister-in-law, his youngest sister, said she'd never forgive God because he let her brother die. I gave her a New Testament that my husband had used, and he had underlined a verse that pastor in Arizona had told him about so deeply, cut through 2 or 3 pages, and it was, "Knock and it shall be opened to you," that passage. And I gave that to her, and she later accepted Christ, baptized, joined the church. People would come to the house, and my husband would tell them, "You need to be reading the Bible," and it was just a totally, totally different thing. But his death influenced so many people, you know, quit smoking, to accept Christ. And then I was telling them that in our church we had several adult Sunday school programs, and one was a woman's Bible, or not a Bible study, it was that year we were giving testimonies. And this leader kept asking me to do that, and I wouldn't do it. And finally, he died in February, and finally in January she had talked me into it. And when I started thinking about what I talk about, it dawned on me, he had been healed, not the way I was asking God to heal. No. You know, I was asking him to heal him of cancer, but he healed him the right way. No. And it took me almost a year to realize that. And so that was really a neat... So God works in mysterious ways.
It's an interesting example of the way in which mm-hmm. the what happened there enlarge the realm of good. That is, it spread out through all kinds of other people. My friend who died wanted to be Willie Nelson. He spent the last couple of years of his life writing songs and singing them to small and no audiences. And when we went up yesterday, I guess it was, to the falls up here, some of us, on Thursday, we read that the Chief Seattle's, on Chief Seattle Day, we read the what would you say? It's not a poem, it's proclamation, I guess, is what it is. And then we gathered in a circle, and I sang for them the song that my friend sang for us and wrote for us as a table blessing. And every time our family and loved ones were together, we sang this song. And in this song, this again, the spirit of this person continues to enlarge and enliven the human community. And this was our table blessing, and still is, and I figure I'm going to sing it just about every chance I get. And eventually the whole world will sing Gene's table blessing. And it goes, "Say yes to life. Say yes to living. Say yes to joy. Say yes to giving. Say yes to love. Say yes to life with God." That by a fellow who was having tumors removed from his head every 6 weeks in the last fall of his life. he would come out of that surgery and sing that song again. So that that even through tragedy, you know, the spirit can work and enlarge and grow. And I would say, coming back circle just a bit, because we're now out of time, through political action, the kinds of interactions that we have with family, loved ones, friends, at college, with a spouse, with friends, occur when people get together, like your example, when people get together around common values and work for justice. I can walk into a room of strangers who are working together on a justice project, and there is already a spirit of love in that room. Whether those people are Christians or Jews or unchurched, there is a spirit of the Spirit as those people gather together to transform the human community for us all. And I think that that's just another manifestation of the way in which spirit is manifest in interpersonal relationships in political groups, as well as family groups and, you know, school groups and various other things. Thank you for your good attention. Vespers is in, I believe, 10 minutes. And Tuesday, in my session, I'm going to talk about, as I said, the stranger rather than the people who are different than us, and how they too can enlarge our knowledge of God. Okay? Thanks, Roger.